When we thought about doing this, I kept thinking, well, do we want to do something different than Sunday, or should I just practice my Sunday message on you? And I thought, yeah, that's the way to go. But then I thought, is that really fair? You know, because you might feel like you're the ones that need it twice. So that wouldn't be right. So I thought about, let's do a Bible study. Let's just take a look at a book of the Bible that, sometimes is obscure. There's, as we go through this, there'll be verses that will, they'll read and you'll think, I remember hearing that, or, I read that before. But we're going to take a look at a little bit, and you've got some notes there that I gave you about the background of James and what really was the reason that James wrote this book. But what he did and what it was in the day was he wanted to deal with the issues of integrity in the church and the authenticity of lives of Christian people. And I said, earlier, it's kind of like the same thing it is today. It's really what, the church really wants to do is try to build people up and build those lives up. And so anyway, that was the whole idea of what James was talking about. He wanted people to get real about Jesus rather than kind of a surface passing of maybe Jesus. And a lot of people, this is a great time that people want to talk about being Christian at election time. That's when everybody, if they're not a Christian, they find religion and then they lose it. Right, sometimes right after election. But I think that's what God is wanting to call us to, is to be a Christian 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And that's what his whole goal is. So James was aware of everything that was going on. So what he's doing in a very loving and kindly way is calling people back to that time of vital Christianity. It was a commentary, as I said earlier, about our time. The note says, it says, our time, and we live in a day when religion is approved, but only to a point. A lot of people will say, I'm a Christian, but never make that commitment of asking Jesus Christ to forgive them. And so I think that's when we talk about people are surface Christians. James telling us that our inner faith, must supplant the outer faith. In other words, it has to be in here before it comes out. And he's talking about returning to true religion. And I've often said in the very first thing that you'll see on the next page is, religion is man's search for God. Christianity is God's search for man. And so, when you take a look at that and you give some thought to that, that's really the difference between people talk about being religious and they're searching for God. But if you're a true Christian, God has already found you and got hold of you and has really changed us. So the author is James. There was three Jameses, three possible James that could have written this epistle, but most attribute it to James, the half-brother of Jesus. And some people will say, what do you mean half-brother? And, did Joseph have children before Mary? And most scholars will say no, he did not. James has been given the credit for writing this, and he is the half-brother of Jesus. James's role in the church, he was a leader of the Jerusalem church, and he led that church there until the late 50s A.D., and the study that I did said that he was martyred, and he was either stoned, beheaded, or thrown off a wall and beaten to death. But the only apostle, or the only disciple, of Jesus that wasn't martyred is John, and John died on the Isle of Patmos. All the other 11 were killed, other than Judas, he took his own life, but of those 12 disciples that followed him, he was the only one that was died a natural death. So why was James written? Most scholars believe James was written to confront the situation of the increasing tension between rich and poor people. And as you know, whatever you know your politics is, if you happen to watch the debate the other night, we've got, one group that said, and I know some of us watched it for a short period of time, but, we've got some there that are saying that we want to take money from the rich and give to the poor, and everybody ought to be equal. And so, one of the things that goes back into the issue in the time of James was the same thing, is that they were looking at, division between people who were rich and people who were poor. And what he was trying to encourage them to be is to live in unity and live in oneness. And he does a really good job of talking about what it is to be rich and how you deal with the rich, how you deal with being rich, and how you deal with being poor. So he's the characteristics of James is really he wants to present the faith to his readers as a good way to live. And I believe that's really why he emphasized obedience in the Bible and in his word. That we need to be a doer of the word, not just somebody that listens to it. But it's part of faith into action, faith and works. We had a couple people coming along, that's been probably 6 weeks ago, knocking on people's door, passing out their magazine that they pass out. Cindy saw them and said, "I'm leaving them with you." And, and that's the works part of it. We do need to share our faith. But the faith part of it is having the faith to share. And to know that beyond a shadow of a doubt, what the Bible says is true. So, let's take a look at what James, what he says in here and go through it. And we'll go through, I think we got about 18 verses tonight, and we'll, take it and see how we go. If we get further, we get further. First verse, from James, a slave of God and of his Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are scattered outside of the land of Israel. Greetings. James's aim or his target that he was going after at this day was to try to talk to people about what true religion really was. What is true religion and how do you find it? And so that's who he's talking to. And he talks about being a slave. James' character, if you look at James a little bit more, is more shown as a servant than as a slave. But in that day, slaves were servants. And servants, in a lot of cases, were slaves. So when you look at that, what it literally means is slave. And James looked at himself as part of God's property. He belonged to God. And that was part of who he was, and that was his whole image. He goes on there to say, to the 12 tribes who are scattered outside of the land of Israel. What, when you looked at the scattered, and that has to do with not only the Jewish community of that day, because they were scattered, and a lot of them had been scattered out into Palestine. But I think it talks to the Jewish community today that are scattered, as well as Christians. We're Christians and are scattered out among people in the world. And I think that's what he's talking to us. He had this desire to really say who he was. James was very comfortable in who he was, very at home in his own skin, What's a good word? He wasn't scared of anybody. He wasn't in awe of anyone other than God, and he was just happy to be known as God's servant. One, he uses that term Lord, and that's the only place other than one other time in the whole book of James, which is only five chapters long, that he uses the word. He uses the term Lord, but that doesn't take away from the fact that the whole concept of the book of James is about Jesus as Lord. and about Christ's return. He does talk about that in there, and that was the main thing and the main emphasis of what James was trying to communicate. That the picture of Jesus Christ and who he had in his mind as Lord dominates the remaining chapters of this when we take a look at it. So he talks in there, you know, about being scattered and about the 12 tribes. That's most likely a reference to the Jewish people in Palestine. But it also, I think, to a Christian reading this today, talks about us being scattered in a world of sin, a world of corruption, a world of deceit, you know, a world of dishonesty, a world of shady business dealings. You know, we see those, you know, all the time, and we hear about them all the time of what goes on. And so I think what he's saying there is the same as a reference to Deuteronomy 30, where he says, "So it shall be when all of these things have come on you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind in all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you." And this goes a reference back in the Old Testament, the book of Deuteronomy that James is making that reference to. So as we look at, you know, as we look at this and we look at the blessing that he is giving to people, what he's saying in verses 2 through 4, he's saying, "My brothers and sisters, think of the various tests you encounter as occasions for joy. There is absolutely no one in this room that likes tests or likes trials. We just don't like them. We got some news last night about, you know, one of the boys, and nothing serious. It's just a personal thing they're going through. But you don't want them to have, you don't want your kids to go through stuff. You just don't. But they do it. And they will continue to do things. And it's nothing that either one of them did wrong. Don't get me wrong. It's, you know, they're not in jail or anything. I'm thankful for that. Just a personal issue of things that happen in a person's life. We don't want to see happen. And I, you know, she's just adorable, let me tell you. And so what he's indicating here is, as we go through these things, but he's saying, count them as a time of joy. And the reason for this whole idea of joy is for perseverance. Because we persevere. And we deal with things as we go on. He says, after all, you know that testing of your faith produces endurance. Let the endurance also complete its work so that you may be fully mature, complete, lacking in nothing. And when, you know, and when we look at that, you know, and for the Christian, we think about, we lack. And, you know, we have this need and we have, you know, multiple needs in our lives. But what he's saying is that through these trials, we endure so that we lack nothing. The whole idea, and we'll get into the rich and the poor and those aspects of it, you know, as we get a little bit further into this. But it's getting the inward faith built up. The Word of God in our lives, that when something comes against us, we're able to deal with it. And we're not overwhelmed by it, and we're not taken back by it, but we are able to deal with anything that comes along, anything in our life that is there to try to ruin us. That's what happens when we have the Word in our, you know, so deep within us. It's kind of a compelling need that we need to just underscore what Jesus is trying to say to the church and what he's trying to say to the individual person today. That we need to be built up individually, because we cannot You cannot minister and you cannot do things outside of that and outside of that relationship with God. So he's looking at, you know, at James as a servant. He's looking at us as a servant. And so there were difficult times confronting the church. And in that time, as we see difficult times now, both within the church and within society. I'd shared Sunday about a picture I saw on Facebook, and you may have seen it, about a pastor standing in front of a jet and a Rolls Royce there, and another, and the Pope in the Pope mobile, the little, you know, when he was here, and it talks about your pastor, you know, my pastor. And that, you know, I mean, there are issues with, you know, with people within churches. Mega churches with, you know, tons of money, spend tons of money. Smaller churches with limited amount, you know, of income or whether they are, spend that money. But I think what he's talking about in the church here is, what are we doing with that? And how are we using it for outreach? And what are we doing with it? So the appropriate responses, you know, that we have when we look at things is, I need to, you know, I will have victory through this. There's a, you know, term in that we use there in James, and he talks about brother. And the term brother or brothers indicates that there's a relationship that he has with his readers. He knows these people. He's been with them. He's worked with them. And it typically is a term that shows that relationship that he has with people. James brings his readers face-to-face with revolutionary approach to adversity and how they deal with that. He urges them to consider diverse trials, and troubles is occasion to, you know, to rejoice. And I said, none of us enjoy trials in rejoicing, but I have often said that trial, you know, I mean, a trial is 10% of your life. Attitude is 90% of it. And what do I see beyond where I'm at right now? The word consider right there, and he's using in 1:2, he said consider all. It's kind of an accounting term that's used, and it really gets down to count or what you deem as correct. It talks about a conclusion. Something's been reached as a result of, you know, whatever's going on. So the idea of considering it joy is difficult for some people to grasp, but that's what we have to do. There's just some things we just don't like to do, and that's just one of them that we really need to do. And he talks about perseverance. He says, you know, in here he says, thinking, you know, while we cannot, you know, prevent trials, we can determine what our attitude and our perspective is on doing those. He uses a term whenever. He says, not if trials come, but he says, whenever trials come. And as much as I said earlier, we would like for them not to come, they do come. And he went out of his way to remind followers that they were going to experience adversity. And I think that's one of the, you know, the maybe one of the most distressing things about modern Christianity is that some teach, and some churches will teach, that there's, you know, an absence of trials in your life. You know, that life is good and nothing can go wrong. And we hear, you know, televangelists, we hear mega evangelists saying that. And I think there is some truth to that, because with the right attitude, you will come out victorious. You do not come out as the victim in a trial. But I also think that we have to understand that life is not absent of trials, and it's not absent of adversity, that life is hard and life is filled with adversity. And we have the option of choosing really how we want to deal with that. So it's one of the things that what he's trying to tell us. He says then that because you know in 1:1, you know the testing of your faith develops perseverance. In the midst of trials, we think, how can I go on? How can I deal with this? What am I going to do to overcome it? And when we take a look at what perseverance means, it just really means, the Greek word for perseverance is press to the limit. You know, and that, and there's a couple different ways of looking at that. You can look at that as I'm pressed to the limit of what I can do physically, what I can do emotionally, what I can do mentally. But I think it's, I'm pressed to the point to what I can do spiritually. And what I can do spiritually is reach out to God. Because that's what he's trying to get people to do, is to get back to the roots of an authentic Christian faith. And we have the option of, you know, option of choosing different things. Option of choosing different ways we want to, you know, we want to deal with the testing. Difficult times are to be accepted. It's how we overcome the adversity, how we deal with, you know, with the resistance that's there. But it's all about perseverance, and it's all about coming through it in victory. One of the things that I read this week, and it said, I think there was a note there, that perseverance is not a virtue. And I'm thinking, you know, why wouldn't it be? You know, if I've done it enough, you know, it would become, you know, it would become a virtue. But it says it's a positive development in one's commitment to Christ. Perseverance is not an end in itself. It does not happen instantly. It's lifelong. I grew up in a church that thought that a person was saved and then they were sanctified. And it was, you know, two individual works of grace and you were perfect after the second one. And I can attest to the fact that it didn't work with me because I wasn't perfect. And one of the things that the Methodist Church teaches and Wesleyan theology teaches is it is a growth process and that we never become perfect until we meet Jesus. And I believe that because no matter how hard we try, we're going to make mistakes. Maybe on a daily basis. I'm not just looking at you. But I just happened to look over there. But, you know, but we're going to make them. And things are going to happen in our lives. And we're going to sit there and try to figure out how'd that happen and why'd that happen. And sometimes there is just no explanation. It's just, that's just what it is. He says, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance, which is what the whole thing is about. The character that he talks about is mentioned. It's what we go through and what we develop when we go through a period of testing. It's what character becomes, and that's who we become. It's the, you know, it changes our character. It radically changes us and radically does different things in our life. When those things happen. I raise a note here, I highlight this. It says, more than once has been observed that Christians in North America pray for God to deliver them from trials, while Christians in developing nations pray for grace to persevere. We really have it good. We really do, and we're very, you know, we're very blessed that, you know, that we have what we have. One of the goals that, you know, we want to take a, you know, that we should take a look at, and I think be, you know, be optimistic about and be open-minded about, is that when we endure trials, we do consider it pure joy. It's not, you know, may not be what we want to think, but that's what it really is. Perseverance must finish its work so that we can be mature in Christ, not lacking nothing. That's what happens when we persevere, that we are made perfect in Christ. Well, then you go back and you say, well, yeah, but you said you're not going to be perfect until we see Jesus. And perfect in Christ is attitude. What's the desires of our heart? But there are still desires that come upon us. And James talks about, you know, those desires that we have that cause us to yield to temptation. You know, we can go back and, you know, we'll talk about Adam and Eve. But the word James uses for complete refers to the end product, what we are in the end. What, you know, what that product is, who we are when God's all finished with us and all done with us. He says complete, not lacking anything in verse 4. Sometimes that makes, you know, Christians a little uneasy, their own imperfections. God created us to be perfect. Unfortunately, it didn't last and didn't end that way. But he wants us to become whole people. And he wants us to become mature in Jesus. And I think that's what the whole goal of what he wants to do. It's like a chef that will soak meat in, you know, a tough piece of meat or something in marinade or, you know, some type of... And my son's grandfather was a building contractor. And he did a lot of work for William Underwood. They made the Underwood deviled ham and all that stuff. And if you ever walked in the factory, you wouldn't eat it again. But they have hams bigger than I was in these big, huge vats of brine water to soften them up, I guess, enough so they could grind them up. And that's what, you know, I think God is trying to get us, you know, to realize that's his way with us. It's not, you know, it's not just slapping some type of marinade on a tough piece of meat and then cooking it and thinking it's going to be tender. But it's that whole process that goes into that and into getting us to where he wants us to be. He says in verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. I think, you know, the crucial link there to preserve through, you know, to persevere through trials is wisdom. And it's really what it is. Wisdom, James is talking about, is understanding God's ways and accepting that life that comes through understanding. And that's what, you know, that's what he's trying to get through to us. Asking cannot be made in a state of confusion, a state of wavering. And that's because that's what brings about double-mindedness that he talks about. A double-minded person fights and argues from within. He doubts. He's like, you know, the wave of the sea. It's the Bible, it says in verse 6, he says, he who doubts like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind, that man should not think he will receive anything from the Lord. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all that he does. The first two double-minded people in the world were Adam and Eve. Because they had that, as they were, you know, created perfect, put in the Garden of Eden, and yet the desire of their heart, and that's where blame first became, blame somebody else, that's the desire of their heart was to have the wisdom of God. If you really think about it, it wasn't to eat, you know, to eat the fruit off of the tree, the apple off the apple tree, you know, if it was an apple tree. The fruit wasn't what was so appealing. Even though, you know, Satan approached the aesthetic value of what the beauty of the tree was. But it was a desire within their heart to be like God. And so what we ended up having, you know, and seeing there was Adam and Eve, or Eve initially, and then Adam also, becoming double-minded, arguing with himself, arguing with, is this right? Is this wrong? What's the desire? It becomes an inward desire of their heart. Same thing happened in the Old Testament. There's many references in there about kings, and it says in 2 Chronicles 25:2, and it was talking about one of the kings. He said he did the right thing in the sight of the Lord, yet not with a whole heart. He did the right thing, but he had the wrong attitude. And so what the essence of genuine faith is believing is that God can and will respond to those of us who earnestly seek him. I think the greatest illustration maybe of being double-minded, it goes back to, you know, the verse there we talked about, that being tossed about like the wave of the sea. That's the wave is unstable. It has really no idea where it's going. And the thing that's important, I think, to keep in mind that there's outward forces determining what it's going to do. There's wind. There's atmosphere. It's not just the water. It's not just that way, but there's outward forces telling it what it's going to do and how it's going to go about it. So what James is trying to do here is to remove any middle ground and just let people understand that in order to persevere, you have to use wisdom and you have to overcome your own personal desires. He says in verse 9, he says, the brother in humble circumstances ought to take pride in his high position. Rendered literally, this verse says, to let the humble brother boast in the height of him. The idea is humble circumstances are akin to the humility which God himself exalts. And that was getting into what this argument was about rich and poor and poverty. Poverty may contribute to people's trials in life. And we had a couple I talked to this week that had needs, you know, and so we do what we can to help them. But you look at their situation as well as any other person's situation. And when you're poor, you may do things that you may not do if you're rich. If you're rich, you may well do things that you do. You may do things that you wouldn't do if you were poor. You know, so it kind of does balance itself out. What James wants us to assure is that the poor are merely changing circumstances. And a person that's poor become rich is not the answer in life. Perseverance is the answer in all things. That's what his whole goal is. And he says in verse 10, he says, but the one who is rich should take pride in his low position because he will pass away like a flower. He's not saying that it's wrong to prosper, but what he's saying is that will fade away. Like a flower will. It's going to die. And there's going to be nothing left. And so anyway, the rich are to need to take some comfort in their possession. But they also need to realize that true religion is not based on temporary wealth. It's there, and they're blessed with it. Because he goes on to say, for the sun rises with scorching heat and withers the plant. Its blossom falls and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he goes about his business. So on either side of the economic fence that a person's on, whether they're, on the poor side or on the rich side, the answer to life challenges lies in true religion. It supersedes whether you're rich or poor, and I think that's what he's trying to say here. It doesn't make any difference who you are, or what you are, or what you have. It's not about that. It's about perseverance, and that's what the whole idea of what, he's saying to us here, is that true religion supersedes factors of wealth and factors of acquisition and what a person can get. We typically today find people, and I think when we look at James, is people find their identity in their professions. They find their identity in their jobs. A lot of them find their identity in their income levels. I think it's interesting that one of the presidential candidates has not raised any money personally because he said he didn't need it. And he also says he doesn't want to be tied to anyone. Is that flaunting it? I don't know. I'm not making that judgment or that decision. But James is saying here is that no matter what we have or how much we have, it's going to be like the flower and it's going to wither away. So he has some strong words to the wealthy people. He doesn't have contempt for them. He's just telling them that Jesus is squarely, is the center. And when he talks about, Jesus being the tradition here, and he's writing the rich and poor, that with God all things are possible, it doesn't make any difference who you are or what you have. That's what he's trying to communicate to people. He says in verse 12, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, Because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. In other words, to endure is really to pass the test. When we have endured and we have persevered, we have passed the test. Abraham in the Old Testament persevered when he was to sacrifice Isaac, which had to be a real test. But he persevered through that. Conversely, Israel failed on so many, on so many attempts that they did and so many things that they did to try to persevere. But the one who perseveres endures. They pass the test. And what I think that's what he's saying to us here is that you don't give up, but you persevere under trial. And when you do, then you receive the crown of life. And that's what God's promised, to everyone, not just rich people, not just poor people. That's what it's all about. Some people, though, will look at verse 13 and think that God tests us and tempts us. It says, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But if you talk to people, a lot of people will say that God tempts them. They've been tempted by God. We may be tested by God, but we're not tempted. We're not tempted to do evil. We go back in Matthew and we see, we look at the temptations of Jesus. It wasn't God that tempted Jesus. It was Satan that tempted Jesus. And what happens is that free will that we have, that ability to make choices, that ability to make decisions, gives its way sometimes to desire. And so we desire things that are not good, and they're not good for us. And what we find out here is that the important difference between trials and temptation is the trial is there, but it's something to be overcome. The temptation is something that's there that can be overcome. Trials are there to help us persevere. Temptation's there to destroy us. Because they're both, they both desire. The 15th verse in chapter 1 says, then after desire was conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Desire really produces an offspring in that we act on our desires and consequences result. Cindy and I have had multiple conversations about consequences with two young men that were in the house. And my cop-out every time was, well, if you don't do your job, what's your consequences? You get fired. And you need to understand there are consequences, good and bad. Good consequences is I'm persevering. Bad consequences is I have to back up and say, Lord, forgive me. And give me another chance. Fortunately, he will. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. God's the same. He never changes. Sometimes we fail to acknowledge who God is and fail to really appreciate who he is. But he's at our heart tugging and trying to get us to do the right thing and trying to get us to follow what he would have us to do and follow the places that he would like to take us to. We have to get there. It said in verse 17, the Father of heavenly lights. That's really the correct view of really who God is as far as James is trying to project it. He doesn't change. He stays the same. He gives light. He gives direction. He's there. He's there for us. He's there to protect us. He chose to give us birth, verse 18, through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. He chose. God chose. Those two words are filled with truth. when we look at that, is in fact God's choice that we were given the opportunity to trust Him. And so James's appeal for practicing real faith is really centered around everything we do in the name of religion. It becomes a response. We are simply responding to what God's already done when He chose to redeem us.
Great. Music?
Thank you.